Media are active agents of a counter-revolution. Interview with Aravind Rajagopal, Professor of Media Studies, New York University. Aravind Rajagopal is a Professor of Media Studies at New York University and is an affiliated faculty in the Department of Sociology and Social and Cultural Analysis, New York University. In 2010-11, he was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. His books include Politics After Television, Hindu Nationalism, and The Reshaping of the Public in India, Cambridge 2001, which won the Ananda Kentish Kumaraswamy Prize from the Association of Asian Studies and the Daniel Griffiths Prize at New York University, both in 2003, and the Indian Public Sphere, Structure and Transformation, Oxford in 2009. In an extensive email interview with Abhish K. Bose, he discusses the practices of media and the governmental role in clipping media freedom in India. Excerpts. We were supposed to have a communication revolution. The general opinion is that the press is under assault. The print media is facing a downslide throughout the world and India is not an exception. Layoffs of media persons are no longer news. Can journalism go down without pulling down the communication revolution? The idea of communication revolution has been around for nearly a century now. Its meaning has changed as we moved from radio to television to the internet and from state control to market-driven media. But the idea is rarely analyzed, so the claim always seems to be new. So, it is interesting that old media, like print, appear like the last custodians of values in public life, and that those values, such as fairness, integrity in communication, and social concern, seem to be endangered with newer media. Technological advance was always thought to imply social advance or progress. In fact, each phase of the communication revolution was expected to surpass the achievements of what came earlier. The downslide you mentioned suggests that we did not get what we expected. If the communication revolution is turning into a counter-revolution, as I believe it is, we have to look beyond received accounts to understand why. We have been living in the communication revolution for more than half a century, and we were so convinced it would take us into a better future that we did not think history mattered. History, we thought, is literally for losers. Well, this is a moment when we risk becoming losers. Liberalism, however, wobbly, was the sheet anchor of post-colonial culture in India and today is no longer available. Such an event reverberates across all domains, including the media industry, where content is treated merely as an audience aggregator, even if that content is false or antisocial. When liberals had railed against government control over media until 1995, when the airwaves were open to the private sector, the assumption had been that the state monopoly was the biggest problem in the media field and that private companies would unquestionably improve the broadcast culture. Without state monopoly, however, all brakes were lifted on a purely revenue-oriented model. In this commercial model, existing prejudices were dressed up and made attractive so that in some respects, a kind of cultural regression was set in motion. You are surely not implying that everything that happened during the era of the state control was good? No, of course not. The challenges of forging a democratic nation when social and economic reforms had not taken place were acute. Nation building involved in some respects one step forward and two steps back. There could not be a simple linear movement forward given these challenges. In fact, there is one form of cultural regression that dates from the time of independence, that is the nearly exclusive focus on domestic matters and a relative lack of interest in international issues. It is an understandable side effect of nation building when it is as if a proper nationalist attitude means avoiding foreign temptations as far as possible. It was as if one had to purify oneself of foreign ideas and substances which could be treated with suspicion. If you look at the Indian newspapers before and after independence, It is striking how international the reportage was before independence and how a domestic focus rapidly took over. Yes, India was part of a worldwide empire before 1947. But for nationalist politics to be effective, it had to be sensitive to the international opinion. And often that sense of an international audience went together with internationalist politics. Independence led to a much more self-absorbed face. Although liberalization flooded India with foreign goods and media, and foreign expertise has become more important, an India first or a region first stance is still common. It can be hard to retain an Indian audience if you start talking about international influences. It is a paradox that media, which as both idea and institution, were promoted by the United States Empire, but have helped to deepen nationalism and parochialism. Indian media took shape as one chapter in the communication revolution, which was an international process. What are the implications of the communication revolution being, as you say, international? How did its international character impact India? When the communication revolution was launched, it was accompanied by a major attempt to professionalize journalism. This followed the recommendation of the Hutchins Commission's report on the media, conceived during the Second World War and completed in 1947, with the entire operation funded by the media magnate Henry Luce. This event is not well known outside the US, but it had long-term consequences. The report had a hostile reception in the US press since it was critical and aimed at reform. There were various recommendations for preserving public media that stirred debate. Perhaps the most consequential recommendation was that universities include communication, which included journalism, as a full-fledged discipline of research and training, equal in stature to the older disciplines, at least in institutional terms. This was a move that was heeded and replicated around the world. The Indian Institute of Mass Communication was founded in 1965 with a grant from the Ford Foundation to ensure that India had its own communication experts. Over time, other institutions began to be set up to teach the subject. A history of how the field was shaped in India is yet to be written, but I think there was a lot of suspicion among the established academic disciplines about this upstart field promoted by the Americans. Over time, however, communication became professionalized in India too, by academic training with institutional pedigree. The outcome was to provide respectability to the rapidly expanding personnel of the media industry. College training and certification became a requirement for one to be hired in the news industry. Previously, the industry largely operated at the fringes of respectable society, as a British civil servant, Humbert Wolfe, wrote in 1920s. "You cannot bribe or twist, thank God," the British journalist. But seeing what the man will do unbribed, there is no reason to. American journalism. It is a well-known fact that British journalism is led not by the Times or the Guardian, but by tabloids. But where is the US in this picture? American journalism was, if anything was, for example, the newspaper baron William Randolph Hearst helped to provoke a war between the US and Spain in 1898 by carrying a fake news about Cuba's treatment of American citizens. The excuse was a nationalist assertion, but it was only a cover for ensuring increased revenue. For a business magnate of the next generation like Henry Luce, brazen greed was no longer respectable, whereas if you claimed to be upholding an idea or a principle, even a reactionary one, it was more acceptable. Maybe that too was partly a media effect. Born in China to American Christian missionary parents, Luce believed the United States' destiny was to be the world's leader. During the Second World War, he foresaw that the 20th century could be the American century. A fervent Republican who opposed President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, Luce formulated what would later be called soft power as the means by which the United States would dominate the world. According to Luce, it would be a fair-dealing form of leadership with America's democracy as a model for all to follow. For this leadership to be possible, the media industry needed to be held to higher standards. The communication revolution reflected great optimism in what technology could do for development. It was also a way of bypassing more difficult questions about wealth redistribution and social reform. As its own proponents pointed out, it was not a real revolution but rather an attempt at capitalist revolution that was the attraction for the United States in promoting the growth of media technology internationally. You have conveyed the importance of an international framework for understanding media institutions domestically. But what was the communication revolution's trajectory in the Indian context? Western proponents of the communication revolution paid little attention to the achievements of previous epochs and of other cultures. They often assumed that the communication revolution was filling a vacuum in national and international communication. This was a misleading idea. In fact, dense and efficient information networks across the Indian Ocean region and Central Asia long predated the arrival of the British. For example, Buddhism spread far and wide through the movement of people with only rudimentary technologies, and that was millennia ago. If we examine the consequences of communication technology from the onset of printing, the outcomes are different depending on where we look. It was in China that printing was first invented, for instance, for printing money, but no major change followed. In India, printing spread with the arrival of Westerners, but the change was slow to come. Communication technologies were not the driving forces in the freedom struggle. On the contrary, independence occurred despite such technologies, which in any case belonged overwhelmingly to the British. Europe fabricated mythologies about white supremacy and the inferiority of the rest of the world while relying on print. In other words, printing led to many things, only some of which were enlightened and revolutionary. To assign an irresistible progressive force to communication technology is mistaken. The communication revolution, as I noted, was an American formulation dating from the 1930s. The development of the US was the first case where the development of communications, roads, canals, railways, telegraphs enabled industrialization instead of other way around, as in Europe. But the US was not like other countries, since it took shape after the feudal era and had no strictly feudal class as such. In most places, existing elites sought to reinforce their control over society and directed the development of communication to limit any radical outcomes. In India, upper castes have dominated business and politics in most areas, and media control was one aspect of such domination. There is more contention and debate now, but by and large, that remains the case. Death knell of secularism. Let me return to the question, how did the communication revolution proceed in India? Today, we notice that even major media houses are sidelining ethical aspects. How do you explain the diminishing ethical standards, even on the part of leading media? Bharatiya Janata Party leader L.K. Advani, when describing the media during the 1975-77 emergency, said, "When they were asked to bend, they crawled." The speed with which the Indian media adopted the crawl under Advani's own party is remarkable. The Times of India is often named for inaugurating the practice of devaluing editorial judgment and abandoning ethical norms with its paid news contracts with private parties. It became so successful that others felt they had to imitate the Times of India. Looked at in this way, it is a purely marketing logic. It culminates in a race to the bottom, as P. Sainath has observed. But there are at least three factors, when taken into account, that offer a large view of this development. We should begin with the vernacular or Indian language newspaper, which predate and outweigh the English language press in terms of their reach and popular exposure. The identification of journalism with the national movement was very strong, and this strength was mainly in the vernacular press. The English language press was mostly colonial, the Hindu being one of the exceptions. After independence, the vernacular press suffered a loss of status, certainly in North India, where the Hindi press suddenly became regional rather than national. As regional politics disarticulated from national politics, it reflected ground-level realities, and this did not necessarily mean greater accuracy in all respects. For example, In the cow belt, Hindu conservatism was influential partly because that reflected the owner's outlook. There were, of course, great variations within each language stratum. But market forces impacted the vernacular press much more, partly because government support for it was less than what the English press received. As a result, the norms, say in the Hindi press, were at times much closer to commercialism of the Times of India today. For example, Hindi newspapers at times reproduced sensational fake news because they believed it was good for their business. Communal rights were always a selling proposition, even if the stories about Muslim insults or injuries to Hindus were untrue. If English language media have succumbed to money over morals, one way to think about it is that the majority practice has spread from the hinterland to the metros, so to say. This is not to argue that the English press was better. Rather, it is to question the simplicity of the story we often get, as if when Samir Jain decided that Bennett and Coleman, the Times Group, were in the advertising and not in the news business, that was where the troubles began. What allowed the vernacular culture to move upward from below points to our second factor, namely a transformation in the way national culture defined itself. Roughly put, certain aspects of vernacular culture, especially from the Hindi belt, became politically fashionable over time. The regionalism of politics, the decline of the Congress, and the rise of the BJP are all important here. Last but not the least is the international context. Crucially, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. In the Indian press, the fall of the Berlin Wall was hailed by big business and by the BJP. They declared it was the death knell of Nehruvian socialism. Industrialists such as J.R.D. Tata, Rahul Bajaj and Viran Shah were writing newspaper columns welcoming the end of Nehruvian socialism. But it was the death knell of secularism too, though we did not know it at that time. In fact, organizer, the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh mouthpiece, equated the destruction of the Berlin Wall with the Babri Masjid demolition. The Indian left may have thought that it had strong national roots, but the attack on democratic forces steadily grew after that. Without an international perspective, we would assume the rise of the right wing to be a purely domestic phenomenon. But look around and you see it is a larger story. There continues to be a resistance, but it is taking place in a larger context, which we must try and understand. The decline in media is not only a reflection of a larger political decline. The media are now active agents not of national development, but of a counter-revolution. Is it that the communication revolution is not necessarily democratic? The government is using its influence to control the media. Do you agree? In India, the idea of a communication revolution arrived as a state initiative. Even industrialists such as Vikram Sarabhai assumed this because only an entity like the state could negotiate with foreign military institutions and obtain the needed satellite technology. Private sector benefits would be downstream. It was only in 1990s that the private sector went upstream and acquired a major presence in the field. Until then, communication was a function overseen by the government of India. Since a revolution seeks to change the existing balance of force, it cannot occur without force. Any government will claim the people's mandate when it does this, although its force is likely to be transfigured in positive ways. The question might be, what kind of balance is there between authoritarian and democratic tendencies and between equality promoting and equality diminishing outcomes? Here the emergency was a turning point. Expenditure in government communications grew many times, and satellite television was also introduced at that time, as it happens. After the emergency, once the Congress returned to power in 1980, authoritarian publicity of the kind witnessed with, for example, family planning became much more discreet. Market reforms began to be introduced. With the growth of television, telephony and the internet, the accompanying claims about an information revolution became palpable. BJP's Shanti politics. Would the Congress have been any better if it had as much power as the BJP does today? Many people would question your assumption. The Congress and the Jan Sangh or BJP grew together. For a long time, it was difficult to make a hard and fast distinction between the two parties. The conservative outlook of many Congress members found organizational form in the Jansangh, which morphed into the BJP. Thus, in 1992, K.N. Govindacharya, who had until 2000 been the party general secretary, had said, BJP minus Congress equals RSS, in a personal interview. He was suggesting that the two parties were substantially the same. The only difference was that the BJP had the RSS as its grassroots cradle. In this line of thinking, many examples of undemocratic practice can be mentioned, which indicate that the Congress was also authoritarian and thereby reject the notion that the BJP is materially different. A recent book on the emergency makes exactly this argument. One major difference, however, has become more important over time. For all their defects, there were always Congress leaders who believed that they could evolve in the process of political struggle. Whereas it is doubtful if the RSS, which is the BJP's think tank, did so. Recall there was mass resignation when the question of a dual membership was raised in the Janata Party period. Members chose to remain in the RSS, which was a secret organization, rather than with the Jansangh, which was subject to the rules applicable to all electoral parties. As the BJP has grown stronger, it could have evolved to build on the strength of its interlocutors and coalition partners. Instead, the go-it-alone pattern has become more pronounced, not less. If today critics are denounced and smeared as criminals or terrorists, that shows a rejection of politics in principle. Democracy only amounts to lip service. In a sense, this is a familiar pattern. Anti-politics is in the party's DNA. Did a Hindutva orientation in the major segment of the Indian population begin as early as the 1980s? Is that why TV serials such as Ramayan attained popularity? Is it possible to enjoy the serialization of the epic without being ideologically oriented towards Hindutva? I undertook a reception study of Ramayan while it was still on the air in 1988-89 in Delhi and a small town a few hours away. Few people I spoke to at that time expressed overtly Hindutva-oriented opinions, even though the Ramayan was the topic. Viewers stressed the pity, the obedience and the sense of lost utopia as what drew them to the show. Taking this towards a campaign to demolish a mosque was on the groundwork in which that time the Congress and the BJP collaborated. It was a Congress MP from Agra, Dau Dayal Khanna, who first raised the demand for Ram Janmabhoomi to be restored to Hindus. The Congress under Rajiv Gandhi opened a Babri Masjid for Hindu worship while prohibiting it to Muslims. And the demolition occurred while P.V. Narasimha Rao's Congress government watched. Essentially, when confronted with a revolt of angry Hindus, the government caved in. This was both a political and a technological issue. Anti-Muslim and pro-Hindu sentiments today are so prominent that it may seem as if Hindutva is the bedrock for the majority society. That is certainly the aim and the claim of those allied with the ruling party. But will this remain true if a different kind of media system replaces the existing one? What if the media circulated messages of peace and inclusion instead of what it does now? That is a hypothetical question, but it shows the extent to which we take the power of technology for granted. T.N. Sheshan, the former chief election commissioner, commenting on the rise of Hindutva, said in 1996 after he stepped down from the office that nothing had changed except the technology. He was, of course, an observer of politics for several decades. Tele-epics such as Ramayana and Mahabharata were commissioned under the Congress. Arun Govil, who acted as Rama in the serial, was even brought in to help campaign for the Congress candidate in the Allahabad election when the serial was still on air. Clearly, the Congress believed it would profit from the serial. What happened? The Congress was in charge, but under its watch, the BJP rose. How did it happen? Media and politics were always intertwined, but the then new media, television, but also audio and video cassettes allowed the challenger the advantage, especially with the symbol of Lord Rama. To adopt an explicitly devotional theme was against Hindutva practice until that time. The RSS chief M.S. Goldwalker stipulates in his writings that no religious symbol could unite Hindus due to their division of creed and sect. A new national symbol was indeed, and that was the Bhagavad Dwaj, the saffron flag of the RSS, Goldwalker argued. But Ramayana's popularity persuaded the BJP to believe that a campaign centered on Rama could work. So in answer to your question, even BJP members were enjoying the Ramayana serial without thinking about any political implications until quite late. It was only in June 1989, more than 2 years after the serial began, that the BJP declared Ram Janmabhoomi would become a national campaign issue. Jay Dubhashi, who was an important policymaker for the BJP then, told me this. When party leaders asked why hardly any members were present at a national meeting held in Ahmedabad, they were told that the meeting had been scheduled at the same time as the Ramayana serial's telecast on Sunday morning. It was then, Dubhashi said, that the BJP realized that there was an opportunity here that they should utilize. You may say there is nothing wrong in practicing the Hindu religion, and any attempt to equate it with supremacism is wrong. By this logic, the majority should prevail, and the demand to treat religious practice as private and keep public spaces neutral is simply irrelevant. But as B.R. Ambedkar pointed out, the political majority should not be defined in such a way that it becomes a permanent majority. The only way to ensure that is to support the conditions for a social and economic democracy and thereby ensure that minorities can exist with a dignity and without a repression. A political democracy cannot exist without social and economic democracy. Today we have social media, which has changed the situation. All the media have to be faster and show they are closer to people. Are you taking these changes into account? Thank you. Yes. Media is a catch-all term and encompasses many different things. For example, there used to be a distinction between big media and little media, that is, between mass media out of reach of ordinary people's input and small media that were more local and accessible. The latter had a far lower threshold of entry. In principle, almost anyone could become a media producer. During the Congress monopoly over the airwaves, for example, the VHP, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, propaganda circulated via audio and videotapes. Of course, the Congress gave the BJP what is in retrospect the great gift of the Hindu tele-epics, which catalyzed Hindutva and allowed it to conceive a nationwide program in the late 1980s. Today, the distinction is between mass media and social media, where similarly, there is a high and a low threshold of entry respectively. But now, the two can be coordinated and joined into a weapon of a kind we have not seen before in politics. Not only are few people spared their feelings and imaginations and are also conscripted into the game along with their cognitive faculties. Whereas previously politics was a low involvement exercise for the majority in India. There is a Tamil saying, Rama Randena, Ravana Nandena. What does it matter whether Rama rules or Ravana? One can still hear the saying, but I think much less than before. Courtesy, Frontline, March 2022.